Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Nancy Dixon, editor of a new anthology, NO Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature, and Angela Carl, author of Where Writers Wrote in New Orleans. We'll also hear from poet Gina Ferrara, whose new book is Amber Porchlight. Nancy Dixon teaches English literature at Dillard University after years of teaching at the University of New Orleans. She is the author of Fortune and Misery, The Life of Sally Rhett Roman of New Orleans, which was named Humanities Book of the Year in 2000 by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Now she's back with what is truly a labor of love, N.O. Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature. Nancy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on this book. It is huge. 560 pages of such amazing writing.
Thanks so much.
Ah. Now, a lot of writers say they write the books they want to read. But for you, you wrote the book you wanted to teach in your classes.
I did, and I also wrote the book I wanted others to read. I wanted others to learn as much about the crazy literature of the city as I did while I was compiling the book and also while I was teaching. I learned so much from my students and what they liked, what they didn't like, what worked, what didn't. So it was for both, for teaching and for readers.
And you've been teaching and writing about New Orleans literature for a very long time.
I started in graduate school under Dr. George Reinecke, who, as I say in my intro, I channeled often when I was doing the research because he was such a font of knowledge and also just a great mentor. Mm.
So tell us how you made your choices. You have so many writers in this book and so many different types of writing.
Well, as I said, that was probably the most difficult part of the project. But as I said, I was kind of like a curator for an art show at a museum. Actually, I ended up taking the historical route, and I'm really interested in history of the city. So I looked at the city historically, and I wanted to get people to get a picture of the time when these writers were writing. And I believe I accomplished that in many. For instance, the first play by Leblanc de Villeneuve, The Heroism of Puchahuma, and how that's echoed later in Tom Dent's play, Ritual Murder.
Right.
Some 200 years later.
There's a lot of drama in this book.
There's actually more than I had anticipated. I didn't know how rich the drama of the city was when I began my research some 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But it's invaluable, I believe, to readers of New Orleans literature because they understand what people not only were reading, but what they were watching, mm-hmm. what they were flocking to the theaters to see, what was popular at the time. And I think that's a really important aspect of the book.
So talk a little bit about the connections between that first play and between Tom Dent's Ritual Murder, which I think is such a lucky, good thing that we have that available for readers now so easily.
So do I, and it's so germane today, that play. The first play, Leblanc's play, was about a young Indian brave who goes out and drinks the fire water and kills one of his friends, a brave from a neighboring tribe. And then skip 250 years, and Tom Dent's play has two young African-American men in a bar in the Ninth Ward, and James Robert stabs his best friend. And after they've had too much to drink, and Dent, in the end of his play, says that these murders are ritual. They happen way too often in New Orleans, and we know that that's still the case today.
And here we are.
And so, here we are.
Yeah. You've brought some other things to light in this book that are quite wonderful and so important in our literary heritage. I'm thinking of the work of the Lacenelles poets.
Lacenelle was, they're fascinating to me, and I didn't put them all in here because there's 17 of them, and it would have been too long. I put several in, but they were the first African-American anthology of literature ever, and many of them had published before in an anthology that was published by a white editor, and Armand Lanousse wanted to have one by their people for their people. And they're very proud Creoles who love the Catholic Church and love the fair sex of Louisiana, as they say in their opening poem.
And tell us about Los Isleños Décimas.
The Décimas. The Isleños came, of course, under Galvez to populate the Louisiana countryside for the Revolutionary War and to get more people from Spain over here after Spain took over from France. And they started writing and singing of their trials and tribulations and work and love and prayer. And they still continue that tradition today, although it's fading. I really wanted that in here because not very many people are around to sing the Décimas, to write the Décimas, mm-hmm. and perform them.
And you've also included Sally Rhett Roman, who is a longtime scholarly preoccupation of yours. And this is the Christmas story in this book.
It is a Christmas story. It was the only one of her stories that was published in a national magazine. Almost everything else she published in the Times-Picayune or the Times-Democrat. So this reached a wide audience, and I was hoping that it would appeal to a wide audience again.
And you sort of rescued her.
I did rescue. I resuscitated her.
Yes, you did. And what about her work speaks to you?
Well, that she's a woman who ended up being the breadwinner for her family of 11 children, many of whom were working by the time she started writing, but still she had a rather large family to support, and her husband couldn't find work as a judge. And this is a woman who worked every single day. She had something in the paper. It's mm-hmm. really fantastic.
Oh, no. Such an amazing life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So good. Thanks for rescuing her. Now, were there any works that you had to leave out because you couldn't get the rights to them? Did you?
Yes. One in particular was Toys in the Attic by Lillian Hellman. And we couldn't find it. We just couldn't track it down for over a year. We couldn't get a lead. And I did know that if we published it, we'd find out.
Yeah, you'd find it right away.
Easily enough, but we couldn't. And it was her only story based in New Orleans, but New Orleans doesn't play a huge role in the play. Although I do like the play, and I did want to, initially I wanted to include it, but it was really long too. So I don't know that it would have ended up on the cutting room floor anyhow.
Right. Well, you had a lot to work with, I have to say. This anthology comes right up to the present with writers like Moira Crone and Fatima Sheikh. So who are the other New Orleans writers you see coming along that you admire and follow?
Well, I was going to go all the way to the present, post-Katrina, and do the 21st century, but the writing in the 21st century increased exponentially. I didn't have the room in the book. It wouldn't have been a book that anyone could read. And it would have been too long or carry. And I didn't have the time. And so I do want another volume that begins in the 21st century. But I stopped at the end of the 20th century, as I said, or just at the beginning. All those writers are still active in writing. But because I thought 200 years would make a good, doable and easy to organize anthology. Now, you know, I love, back to drama again, I love Moose Jackson's Lugaroo. Mm-hmm. And that was originally intended to be in here, as was Joe Longo's Sinners, a short story that appeared originally in French Quarter Fiction. But when I decided to stop, I was sad to see works like that go, but nonetheless, I thought I had to stop.
So New Orleans is your home. And when you look for writing about this city that speaks to you, what is it you're really looking for?
I guess I'd have to go back to Eudora Welty and talk about the sense of place like she does. And I really want some literature that captures the place. I mean, not every one of these stories or plays or poems is set in New Orleans.
Right.
However, New Orleans echoes in the work some sort of way. And I really think that's important in the fiction that I read today. Some of it was so refreshing. There wasn't, you know, when you'd find someone who didn't write about Mardi Gras and didn't write about second lines, and you know, it's like, okay, great.
Thank you.
But so I don't want it to be trite, but I want it to be fresh, but I also want it to, like I said, have a sense of place.
Interesting. It's been a pleasure to talk with Nancy Dixon, whose new book is N.O. Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature. You can meet her Saturday, December 14th at 4 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville, or Monday, December 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Angela Carl is the former real estate editor for the Times-Picayune, and that passion for New Orleans buildings and architecture and their magical effect on people has never left her. She's a licensed tour guide, and she can tell you about ghosts and cemeteries and other of the more fascinating aspects of our city. But she's here to talk about her new book, Where the Writers Wrote in New Orleans, which talks about famous New Orleans literary places and people. Angela, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Now, for anybody who loves books, this is a treat. And you've been interested in New Orleans writers for as long as I've known you, which has been a long time.
Not that long. I started this when Russ, my husband, and I were trying to raise money for the New Orleans Public Library. And we thought, well, if people like reading, the ones that support the library probably do, they might like to meet some of the writers that they read. So we thought we'd have a little luncheon and have all the writers. So we thought there'd be 20 to 25 people there. Y'all, I got to the 200 mark, and I still had writers. I could not believe there are so many writers in New Orleans. And that really sparked my interest in writing about writers.
And there are lots of them still, even more.
You know, an old wag said there's more writers and less readers in New Orleans than any other city in the country. But there's a lot of readers here also. But there are plenty writers.
And you worked with two really well-known architects and preservationists on this book, didn't you? That must have been really fun.
I was so lucky. Lloyd Sensat and I were tour guides together. And I guess a writer wants to distract herself, so she talks about the book. She doesn't write the book. So for 12 years, I talked about this book. And, of course, I talked to Lloyd and Jean. They live right around the corner from me. So Lloyd had a lot of drawings, and they seemed to fit in the book because some of the drawings were of where writers lived. So I persuaded him that he should give me all these drawings and I would use them in the book. So he brought them over on February the 9th, 2011, which happens to be my birthday. So I thought that was a really like precipitous event. 2 days later, February 11th, Lloyd dropped dead while giving a tour. So his partner, Gene, and I went into shock. We had no idea what to do, and we were just, for a year, we didn't know what to do. And I didn't really know who owned the drawings then. And Lloyd had a 95-year-old mother in a nursing home in Crowley, and I was thinking about, do I have to go over there and talk to her? Well, finally, Gene and I recovered a little bit and came back to life. And then we started talking about, let's do the book in memoriam to Lloyd. And Jean said, well, I have a few drawings that I'd like to put in the book, too. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. So the illustrations, I don't want to put myself down, but the illustrations really, really make the book.
And it is a lovely memorial to him because he was so loved.
He was very much loved. He used to play Papa Noel in my neighborhood, you know, in Faubourg Marigny. And a lot of the neighbors know him. A lot of people in New Orleans know him. And it is a great memorial. And I think that's what kept us going because, you know, writers and illustrators, what we really look for is distraction. We don't want to write. We don't want to draw. What we want to do is nothing. So that kept us kind of going. And that's, I think, what made us finally publish the book.
And so much of the book is about the French Quarter.
It is because, you know, the French Quarter was the first neighborhood in New Orleans. So naturally, if you were a writer in 1718, 1719, when the city was first begun, you lived in the French Quarter. There was no other place to live. I mean, that was the city. And the writers have always been drawn to the French Quarter, to that laissez-faire, live and let live atmosphere. So, yeah, the French Quarter is a big part of the writing life.
And big part of your writing life, too.
Yeah, because I only live a block from Bourbon Street.
Yeah. So as you were tracking these places down for this book, what are some of your favorites? What are some of the ones you found that you love the most?
The one that you would have to go see, the Monleon Hotel. A lot of writers stayed at the Monleon. And the Monleon, even today, is a center of literary activity. And they have a showcase in the lobby with a lot of books from Tennessee Williams, Eudora Welty, William Faulkner. And so the first place maybe you'd go is the Monteleone. And it's a gorgeous hotel, you know, and it has the carousel bar, and you can sit there and think, you know, I think Tennessee Williams might have sat right here and had a Pernod or something like that. So you have to go to the Monteleone Hotel first.
And that is, you know, still, Tennessee Williams Festival is there in the spring, Words and Music in the winter.
Yes.
It's just keeping it going all the
time.
And
it's so easy to find, you know. It's right in the French Quarter. I mean, it's a block from Canal Street, right on Royal Street. So it's very easy to find.
And what other places are your favorites?
Well, I guess Tennessee Williams' last home, which is just fabulous, and it's owned by these two doctors now, you know, Brops and Lutz. And they have kept it up very well, and I like to go over there and stand on the balcony. And I've heard, I don't know that this is really true, but I've heard that Tennessee would show up in his fur coat, and he would have his manservant hold the fur coat while he took a dip in the pool. Au naturel.
Where are those photographs?
Yeah, right. If I had those photographs, I would be a rich woman.
I know. That is a great, great spot. It really is.
Yes.
Now, don't you find in your role as a tour guide that people come to New Orleans and they do have certain literary preconceptions about the place?
They think that the writers that live here were mostly homosexuals and all alcoholics. And they're pretty right.
I don't know, Angela. I don't know about that.
Good. Don't look it up. It might be wrong. But a lot of the writers were gay. They were homosexuals. And I'm convinced that all of them were alcoholics. But so are most of the people that live in New Orleans. I mean, I asked my daughter about a friend of ours, and I said, is he an alcoholic? And she said, well, you know, it's kind of hard to tell because everybody drinks a lot. Like William Faulkner, his landlady just couldn't believe how much he drank. And he said it was because he had a steel plate in his head and it gave him pains. And so he had to drink a lot of alcohol to dull the pain. And she didn't bother him after that. She just let him go ahead and drink.
Well, the search for distraction. There you go.
Right.
Well, we've been talking with Angela Carl, whose new book is Where the Writers Wrote in New Orleans. You can meet Angela Thursday, December 12th at 7 when she discusses and signs her book at East Bank Regional Library. Angela, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me very much.
Gina Ferrara is a New Orleans native who received her MFA from the University of New Orleans. She's an educator who lives near Bayou St. John, which often figures in her work. She's the author of The Size of Sparrows, Ethereal Avalanche, and a new collection just out called Amber Porchlight. It glows with the many lights of our city. Gina Ferrara, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan.
Now, there are three sections in this collection, A Glow, Burnished, and Candescent. I'm always curious to know how poets put collections together. So obviously, these poems in these groups have a kind of kinship and movement for you.
They do. This manuscript really started out with a different identity, and it sort of evolved over probably a 2-year period. And when I was looking sort of at its final stage of evolution, I really noticed how much light imagery was in these poems. And so I started to think about sort of the different qualities of light. How does light look? What types of light do we have? And that's sort of how I grouped the poems.
Oh, well, and then there's that lovely photograph by Jackson Hill on the cover of
An
Amber Porchlight.
Yes.
Oh, now so many of these poems deal with war. I'll never forget that image in the title poem of you and your mother on the porch ringing small bells to celebrate the end of the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, I love to link sort of personal experience with global events, what's happening globally. I love to see sort of the collision, if you will, of those two things. And so when I was a kid, when I was growing up, I grew up during the time of the Vietnam War. When my mother was a child, she grew up during World War II. So we kind of shared those things in common. And it's something that I really like to explore, just sort of seeing sort of what's happening with the country, with the world, and then what's happening inside of a home.
Exactly. And then you have a story of an uncle coming home after the war in 1972.
Right, right. He was changed. He was a different person. And, you know, I was a child at the time, but that was easy for me to see. You know, before he went into the army, his hair was really short and he was younger, but his experience in the army changed him. His hair grew longer. I have another poem in this that's not in this collection, where after he came home, he got a motorcycle, he had long sideburns, long hair, and his experience changed who he was.
And you wrote a poem that's dedicated to Joe Kasson about the war in the Philippines and Bataan.
I did. What people didn't often know about Joe, because he was so quiet, he was the spouse of the poet Maxine Kasson. And Maxine, of course, always kind of took the spotlight when she came into a room. And you could tell by looking at Joe, I mean, just by his demeanor, he was a very tall man. And he didn't say too much, but he always impressed me as somebody who really had a lot within. And I did find out he had an interview that he did where he detailed his experience in World War II. He actually survived the Bataan Death March.
Right. I was so surprised to read that. I really was. And then, of course, there's Nuclear Family Photo. It deals with Hiroshima.
Right. There was a photograph that my mother had that she and her family took a photograph on the day that that happened. And I don't know why they took that photograph, but I think they probably took it in some sort of way to document what was going on. Of course, we lost that photograph in Hurricane Katrina, but the photograph always struck me as they were sort of detailing where they were at the time.
And now, despite all this light in this collection, there's also a lot of liquid of various unpleasant sorts, lots of black water and oil and tar. And, you know, there are some sticky, sticky things here.
Well, life itself is sticky, I think. And based on where we live, you know, we live in a swamp. So how could water, how could liquid not be a part of it? And,
right.
You know, in all of its, you know, in all of its probably less than stellar forms.
And some of the poems, some of the ones I like the most, are about the life of the body. I mean, there's this wonderful poem you have about cutting your husband's hair. There's a lot of hair in this, too. And then there's one about shaving and one about anorexia that is quite, quite moving.
Yeah, that was actually based on a high school experience. And when I was in high school, there really wasn't any name for anorexia. I mean, anorexia still hadn't come into, I guess, its formalized existence.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you to read one of my favorite poems from this collection. It's called Rot and Replicating.
Rot and Replicating. Inspired by the musicality of veins and arteries, I keep this poem within. I breathe and it writes itself near tissues, cells, and familiar red fluid. The pulse is the steadiest muse. Last night I dreamed a pair of herons lifted the lines, then carried them to the island where you are. When the sun rose, you read what was left, a language of double helixes, wrought and replicating, left on the rocks to dry.
You know, I think I just wanted to hear you say the pulse is the steadiest muse. Ever since I read this poem, I've just, it goes through my mind. I just can't get it out. It's lovely, lovely line.
Thank you.
We've been talking with New Orleans poet Gina Ferrara, whose new collection is Amber Porchlight. You can meet her when she signs her book Saturday, November 16th at 3 at Vianne's Tea Salon in Mandeville, and Monday, November 18th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Mary Fitzpatrick and Virginia McCollum sign New Orleans, Days and Nights in the Dreamy City, Tuesday, December 10th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. Then again at the Holiday Home Tour Boutique at Trinity Church Saturday and Sunday, December 14th and 15th from 10 to 4. Garden District Bookshop also presents Joy Castro, signing her new mystery, Nearer Home, and Poppy Tooker and David Spielman signing Louisiana Eats, Tuesday, December 10th from 6 to 9. Today's guest, Angela Carl, discusses and signs Where Writers Wrote in New Orleans, Thursday, December 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Michael Allen Zell appears with Jeff Louviere and Vanessa Brown at the launch of their new collaborative work, The Oblivion Atlas, Saturday, December 14th at 8 at a gallery for fine photography. And here's something really special. Metairie Park Country Day School and the Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans present an evening with Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. Her most recent book is Charles Dickens' Favorite Daughter, The Life, Loves, and Art of Katie Dickens Perugini. She appears Tuesday, December 10th at 7 at Metairie Park Country Day School's Bright Library. And the Dickens Fellowship also celebrates its annual reading of A Christmas Carol, Saturday, December 14th at 2 at Country Day's Bright Library. Rebecca Snedeker and contributors Dana Logsdon and Nathaniel Rich read from and sign Unfathomable City, A New Orleans Atlas, Wednesday, December 11th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Larry Powell signs Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans, Saturday, December 14th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Rob Owen signs Spyboy, Cheyenne, and the 96 Crayons, A Mardi Gras Indian Story, Saturday, December 14th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. And I'll be talking about the best books for Christmas giving, Saturday, December 14th at 1 at the Keller Library. Errol Barron signs Roma Observata, or Rome Observed, Saturday, December 14th at 4 at Octavia Books. The Haiku Society of America presents Haiku Elvis, Carlos Colon, signing his new book, Haiku Elvis, A Life in 17 Syllables, as well as other members of the Haiku Society visiting for their national conference. That's Sunday, December 15th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Contributors to WWNO's Storyville Project, Maurice Ruffin, Robin Bodier, Adam Carlin, Laura Janelle McKnight, Jonathan Brown, Daniel Lawton, and Phyllis Dunham, read Sunday, December 15th at 6 at Siberia Bar, 2227 St. Claude Avenue. And today's guest, Nancy Dixon, signs N.O. Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature, Saturday, December 14th at 4 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville, and again Monday, December 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.